Okay, good morning. The title of my presentation's changed a little bit than what was in your schedule. I wanted to look at racial disparities in vaccination among nursing home residents to see if they narrow by if nursing homes actually have facility vaccination policies. I wanted to look at regional differences because we found really big regional variation, but we just didn't have the power in this data, the National Nursing Home Survey. So give a little bit of background. Although the annual influenza vaccination is recommended by the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, the ACIP, for all residents of long-term care facilities, racial disparities in vaccine uptake have existed. In fact, we've published three studies since 2000 that found at least an 8 to 9 percentage point difference between white nursing home residents and black nursing home residents. And other studies, actually a lot of research that is done in nursing homes looking at quality of care and also indicators of poor quality such as pressure sores and restraint use have found racial disparities throughout. So looking at immunization, it's nothing new. However, a lot of these studies, they kind of distill it down to this message, and one of them put it well. They just said, action must be taken at the organization level if we're to narrow the racial gap in quality of care. And nobody's really looked at that in immunization, but studies have shown that certain facility vaccination level policies are associated with higher vaccination coverage. And those policies include things like standing orders, written protocol for immunizations, documenting refusals, documenting vaccination status in a consistent place in medical records, and also allowing for minimal consent requirements for vaccinations. In other words, allowing for oral consent instead of always needing written. In fact, I think Maryland's the only state that requires written consent. So really the objective of this analysis was to determine if the racial inequity in receipt of the vaccine narrows if residents are in facilities with vaccination policies. And I used the National Nursing Home Survey from 2004. In fact, that's the last time it was conducted. They conduct it periodically. And it's a two-stage cross-sectional sample survey of nursing homes. So that means like the first stage, they sample nursing homes across the country to make so that they'll be representative of all nursing homes in the US. And then the second stage, they sample nursing home residents within those homes. And they'll select up to 12 residents per home. And then the National Center for Health Statistics actually carries this out. They're part of CDC. And those folks actually go to all the nursing homes. It was over 1,100 nursing homes. They visit them, they interview them, for all the questions regarding the facility and also the residents. And they interviewed the staff who are most familiar with the residents who were randomly selected for the study. And this was conducted between August 2004 and January 2005. So our study population really was over 13,500 residents, randomly sampled from 1,152 nursing homes. But to look at the racial differences, there are very few residents of race groups other than white, non-Hispanic whites and blacks, so we only looked at those two groups. And so my main question was really, I wanted to see, do racial differences in vaccination vary if a nursing home has vaccination policies or not? So that's when I say if my main exposure was looking at this interaction between race and facility vaccination policy. And then my outcome was vaccination status. So the way that was recorded is the staff actually had to have some documentation that the nursing home resident was actually vaccinated. So my analysis included logistic regression using Sudan to account for the complex survey design. And I used predicted margins. I just simply like those better than odds ratios. And all they are is just an adjusted probability of being vaccinated. So it's like the probability of whites being vaccinated minus probability of blacks, so I can look at that racial difference. And when I say adjusted, I mean I'm controlling for confounding, and that's just a fancy way of saying I'm holding things constant that could muddle up that relationship. In other words, there's a lot of variables that are associated with race that are also associated with being vaccinated that might have nothing to do with the vaccination policy, so I want to hold all those things constant. And there's quite a few of those things at the resident level, the facility level, and the state level. So that's what this list is. And around this time in 2004, we at the CDC, we added, I'm actually in the Immunization Services Division at CDC, we added a lot of questions to the National Nursing Home Survey. They depend on soft money, that's how they do these surveys. So we added a lot of questions about what kind of vaccination policies the homes might have. And I'm not gonna get into all of them, I'm just gonna focus on the ones that worked well. And we also asked a lot of questions about whether they had vaccination policies for their healthcare personnel as well. And what we found was overall the response rate was very good for the survey. It was 78% overall. And just the overall unadjusted vaccination coverage for nursing home residents was close to 63%. But for whites, it was about 64.1%, and blacks 54.9%. So you can see there's over 9 percentage point difference. But then after I adjusted for all of those confounders, the difference was only about 6.3%. And just to give you an idea, I'm just going to describe the population just by the basic characteristics, just so you can sort of get a feel for what I mean by confounding for the non-epidemiologists. By gender, you can see About 66% of whites are female, whereas 63% of blacks are female. So there's about 10% more black males than white males. And there's a big difference in vaccination too. Black males are more likely to be vaccinated than black females, whereas white females are more likely to be vaccinated than white males. And then for age, there's a different distribution as well. Among whites, less than 10% were under 65 years of age. In fact, 68% of them were 80 years of age or older, whereas for black residents, about 22% were less than 65, and only about 46% were 80 or older. And you can see for whites, the vaccination coverage increases steadily as age goes up, but for blacks, not so much. And then marital status, too. Differences in the proportions. There are more black residents who are divorced, separated, or single compared with whites, and vaccination coverage just changes a little bit among marital status group for blacks, but it's still more differences for whites. And then the regions, about two-thirds, I think, of all the nursing homes in the country are either in the Midwest or the South. Which is kind of reflective more among the white population of residents. And vaccination coverage is almost the same across regions for white. But for black residents, over half live in the South. And vaccination coverage really changes. It's only 43% in the West, but 61% in the Northeast. And then ownership of nursing homes is another interesting variable. For-profit homes or proprietary are kind of known to have the worst quality of care. And about 59% of whites live in for-profit homes, whereas 75% of blacks do. And vaccination coverage, you can tell, is a big difference. Whites in homes that are nonprofit or government have 68% vaccination coverage, whereas those in for-profit homes are only 61%. But for black residents, it's a 14 percentage point difference. And then proportion of residents on Medicaid is usually kind of an indicator of poverty, but for immunization, ends up being, I guess the government's doing its job, because where there's a lot of residents on Medicaid, they have much higher vaccination coverage, particularly here for whites and for blacks. Although vastly more blacks live in homes with where the more of the residents are on Medicaid. That's kind of the opposite for other quality of care indicators. It's the finding is usually the opposite. So here I'm just going to make a point of discussing the vaccination policies that worked really well, and there were five. Standing orders for immunization, for influenza immunization, had the strongest effect. And only about 41% of residents lived in homes with standing orders. And here I'm just going to show you the difference of how many whites lived in homes with these vaccination policies. So about 41% of whites lived in homes with standing orders, whereas about 38% of blacks did. Allowing verbal consent, just a few more blacks lived in homes that allow verbal consent compared with whites. The homes that conducted seasonal vaccination campaigns, probably significantly more whites lived in homes that had such policies, 46% versus 38% of blacks. And then about 44% of all residents lived in homes that conducted routine review of the vaccination rates for that facility. And significantly more whites lived in homes that had that policy. It was 45 versus 37%. And then finally, one of the healthcare worker policies that worked well was vaccinating at least 40% of their healthcare workers, which back then in 2004, that was closer to the national average. It's higher now. But almost 65% of white residents lived in homes that had higher coverage among their healthcare workers compared to 49% of black residents. So here I'm going to show you, this is just the unadjusted vaccination coverage for the five policies. Just to give you an idea, you can see for whites in homes that had the policy versus whites that were in homes that didn't have it, and then the same thing for black residents. For standing orders, you can see is about a 6 percentage point difference for whites, higher coverage if they had standing orders, and then for blacks, 9 percentage points higher. And then verbal consent is very similar for whites, but for blacks is 10 percentage points higher. Seasonal vaccination campaigns, 2 percentage point difference for whites, but about 4 for black residents. Reviewing vaccination policy rates was about 3 percentage point difference for whites, and then so forth. And I'm going to show you, this is the adjusted vaccination rate, so it's a little bit different from the previous slide, but just to show you what the gap was. This is vaccination coverage up on this scale, and then the first vaccination policy I'm going to look at is the standing orders. And the blue bars are for whites. So you can see here, the difference for whites is looks a lot higher than it is for whites in homes that didn't have standing orders. But here the racial gap is only 2.8 percentage points between whites and blacks in homes that had standing orders. And then in homes that don't have standing orders, the racial gap is 8.5 percentage points, and it's statistically significantly different. So not only is it higher for both race groups, it has a much narrower racial gap. And then the same thing for verbal consent. If they had allowed verbal consent, it was less than 2 percentage point difference. If they didn't, it was almost 10. And then among homes that had policies for seasonal vaccination campaigns is close to 4 percentage point different racial gap. But almost 8 if they didn't. And then among homes who reviewed vaccination rates, it's 1.7 versus 9. So you can see some of these really made a difference in terms of that racial disparities. So in conclusion, the vaccination policies reported by nursing homes to be associated with higher vaccination coverage for both white and black residents and to have a narrower gap, a racial gap, included standing orders, allowing verbal consent for vaccination, conducting seasonal vaccination campaigns at different times during the season, routinely reviewing facility-wide immunization vaccination or influenza vaccination rates, and vaccinating at least 40% of their healthcare personnel. Some limitations of the study include when they conducted the study, you know, as I said, it was between August and January. What they do, they ask, did you get the flu shot within the last 12 months? So it could be covering two different flu seasons. So it's not all in one season, and sometimes there's different issues in different flu seasons. No information on the degree of implementation or completeness of the vaccination programs. So what one may say they have standing orders, even though we defined it, to mean the physician doesn't need to sign anything to initiate the vaccination process. Some people still might think of it differently than others. And finally, the data are from 2004, so changes in policies around that time and since then may not be reflected. This is definitely not the most current information. In fact, in 2002, standing orders were at one prior to that, the CMS wouldn't reimburse nursing homes if they had standing orders for immunizations. But they lifted that ban in 2002. So since this was 2004, a lot of homes might not have known that at the time. And there may be much higher prevalence of use of standing orders now. Also, in another study we did at CDC, we found that that homes that required written consent were significantly less likely to get their nursing home residents vaccinated. So when we published that, a letter to the editor was written, and the AMDA, the American Medical Directors Association, they removed that from their toolkit, any forms for written consent. So that was done about the same time as this, so that the proportion of residents in homes that allow for verbal consent may well have changed since then. And then finally, in 2005, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services required to be certified that nursing homes must not only offer, but they also must document vaccine for residents. And about 98% of all nursing home residents in the country are in CMS certified homes. However, that certification is also dependent on many other factors, not just immunization. So I'm not sure how well that's is making a difference. So also, at the time of this survey, really less than 45% of residents lived in homes with the most effective vaccination policies, with the exception of vaccinating their healthcare workers. So more research needs to be done to understand how to facilitate adoption of these vaccination programs. And also, things like if they have standing orders, how often are they vaccinating residents who are in the home at the beginning of the season? I mean, they may have a protocol that is assess and vaccinate people as they come in the home, but what are they doing for the people there during the whole season? You know, that might vary a lot between homes. And also, the homes who conducted the seasonal vaccination campaigns, what time periods during the season are they doing it and how often? And then finally, what policies and programs are facilities doing to maintain adequate healthcare personnel vaccination coverage? And we didn't get a lot of that information. And finally, I'm really curious to see how many facilities actually changed from requiring written consent to allowing for oral consent since AMDA removed that written consent form from their toolkit. That's it. Thank you. If anybody has a question, if you could come to the microphone and identify yourself, please.
Good morning. I'm Linda from Michigan, and my question is about the second presentation on vaccine coverage for pediatric patients. Can you tell me when you determined the number of patients that you were going to include? Did you look at continuity patients that were established with a certain amount of visits, or did you look at any patient that's ever been in that practice?
Yeah, so given the nature of the study, you know, we weren't enrolling patients, you know, we were enrolling offices, and so we relied on the offices to identify the number of patients under their care. But what we asked them to tell us were the number that were, you know, that they would count as actively, you know, under their management, right? So there's a potential, as you point out, that there may be some variation there, but we feel like it's the potential for variability there it shouldn't kind of explain the results that we saw, because, you know, for it to explain the difference in vaccination coverage that we saw, it would have to be that larger offices were overestimating by a factor of two, you know, the number of patients. But
when we look at our rates, we seem to see that our bigger sites sometimes have a little bit of a lower rate, because it's harder when they have so many patients to really track their true continuity patients.
Right.
Or the smaller sites certainly, you know, have a better grip on which patients are truly theirs, though.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, I think that is right. And it may explain a little bit of the effect, but yeah, right.
All right, thank you.
Sure.
I'm Jennifer Sanderford. I'm a rural pediatrician from Colorado, and I have a two-part on late-season vaccine particular to pediatrics. The first is, obviously, I know when late season ends, I mean, your vaccine eventually expires, but when are you defining it as beginning? The second part being, what are the sort of talking points as far as persuading staff to continue vaccinating? I mean, obviously, anytime you increase a vaccination rate, it's good, you're lowering disease burden. But the specifics when you're trying to persuade a staff to proceed with that in April, May, even, you know, the very first part of June, how do you explain why you're doing it?
So for this project, we defined late season as beginning January 1st and running through March 31st. And so that was our season for late season. What wasn't presented here in this presentation was the results from key informant interviews. And those were with the provider, like the head provider, the medical director, a vaccine manager, and an office manager. And what kind of information we got from them was similar to the questionnaire that was done. And it was just like what their feelings basically were for about late season vaccination. And so since this is just our baseline data, what we're We have developed an intervention toolkit, and so what we're working with them on is explaining what their coverage rates were. And so that was like one of our big kind of hitching post for us, is showing them that their coverage rates weren't as high as they thought they were. Because when we did the KII, we asked them about what they think their coverage rates were. And they're like, they were all like, oh yeah, 80, 90%, you know, they thought they were awesome. And we're like, no, 60. So that was a big point for us. And then just kind of showing them ways that they can implement all sorts of different things, from flyers in the waiting room just to raise patient awareness. And then creating standing orders was another big one. A lot of the clinics didn't have standing orders, doing flu-only visits and all sorts of different interventions. What was also interesting from the KII was that physicians said that they stopped offering flu vaccine when patients stopped asking for it. And then the patients were saying, as you saw from the receptivity, I stopped wanting flu vaccine when my doctor stopped offering it to me. And so when we presented that information to the clinics, that it was a pretty compelling message that, oh, wait, my patients will get vaccinated. I just need to offer it to them. So kind of showing them what their rates actually are, and then that message about the patient receptivity are two big interventions.
Good morning, and thank you for your presentations. I'm Lance Chilton from Albuquerque, and I'm a pediatrician also. I have a question at each end of the age spectrum and a comment. The questions with regard to the study of pediatricians' offices is, aside from looking at the size of the practice, did you look at the number of children per FTE pediatrician or per FTE provider, and is there a relation there?
Yeah, we did look at both the kind of staff to patient ratio and also the provider as dictated by basically saying MD to staff. So we looked at both those ratios. The strongest effect was on the total patients, regardless of staffing levels. Obviously, when you do staff to patients, you're using some of that same data so you can see an effect, but the strongest relationship was just, as we presented here, just the straight number of patients.
Interesting. I would guess that a busier practice in terms of number of patients per physician might have a poorer rate.
Right.
The comment at the other end of the age spectrum is that I'm, as a pediatrician, I had no idea of what nursing homes were doing. Although I'm much closer to being in one, I suppose. I'm happy to see that nursing homes can now allow oral consent. In our offices, the layers of paperwork required to give a flu vaccine are in themselves formidable and discourage vaccines in ways that we don't have with the other vaccines we give. I wonder if you'd comment on that.
Actually, I wasn't aware of that, so thank you. I just know that in nursing homes, you know, while there's a lot of dementia, a fair proportion are cognitively impaired, and so their family, somebody in the family has to at least probably, I'm guessing, waive consent to, or at least give verbal consent, so they still have to deal with that issue, I guess. So it's not, you know, as easy as I made it to be, but yeah, thank you.
And my comment finally is that in New Mexico we've done a little bit of looking at adding influenza immunization to the COCASA audits. I'm wondering if the software can be adapted to do that more widely than what we're doing.
Well, that sure would be nice, because we loaded all of our audit data into COCASA and then found out we couldn't do the coverage rate with influenza. So yeah, I agree, that would be great.
Sorry, I'm not the CASA expert. They are down the hall from me at work.
Talk with them.
Thank you. And have them fix that DTaP issue too.
Any more questions? Okay, thank you very much.